I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Robbie Robbie's weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh! Oh!
Magic!
Well, we joked about France somehow finding a way to burst their own potential Grand Slam winning momentum, and it seems they might just have done it with confirmation that head coach Fabien Galthié burst their COVID-19 bubble the day after their big win over Italy. Hello and welcome to the 42 Rugby Weekly Extra after an absolutely jam-packed weekend of rugby. Loads to discuss, including that developing story from France. Murray Kinsale here, and we're joined by Owen Toolan on the line from Japan. How's all going in Japan, Owen?
Yeah, oh well, we actually came out of state of emergency code red today, first day of spring, 17 degrees here, so everyone's bouncing around a little bit, so things are looking a little bit more on the positive side, thankfully.
Happy days, a nice big win for Kintetsu Liners as well.
Yeah, probably not the performance we would have liked, but to be fair to Korea, they made things difficult for us up in Tokyo. Just finding it hard to get some kind of continuity performance going, a game and then a bye into another game, and we go into a bye this week again, so it's a little bit frustrating that we're not getting a run of games, but once you get into next week, then we have kind of consecutive games for the next month or so. So that'll hopefully see the team putting in some more consistent performances.
Karita Water Gush must be the best named team ever.
Absolutely, yeah. A couple of mates playing for them as well. Tom English, that was at the Melbourne Rebels I think he just fell short of 100 caps. He would have been the first guy to get 100 caps for the club. So he's a great guy. He's there. Tammy Ellison was there for a couple of years. Deegan, that was over in Connacht, has gone to Korea as well. So they've got quite a Australian contingent. Ned Hannigan as well, unfortunately he was injured, and would you believe it or not, Wycliffe Paolu is still running around again. Unfortunately he was injured at the weekend, but yeah, I think he's pushing close to, must be getting close to 40 at this stage, but he still makes an impact over in Japan.
That is good going, fair play to him. Hopefully we've got that kind of longevity in our careers. That's really impressive. Listen, absolutely. There's only one place really for us to start in terms of Six Nations. It's with France, as we said. Some brilliant reporting going on from L'Équipe and other outlets just to kind of get this story to this point. But anyway, Bernard Laporte went on French TV last night and basically admitted that Galthié had left the bubble the day after their Italy win. Galthié went to Stade Jean Bouin in Paris to watch his son play there. And Laporte's kind of making the point, listen, he was masked up, it's in open air. I'm not a doctor, but I think people are understandably angered and frustrated with this, certainly given the fact that the Scotland game obviously was postponed. We got a question from Connor here, Owen, and he says, what do you think should happen and what do you think will happen to France now that it's confirmed Galthié broke the L bubble? What's your sense of this? It's obviously a massive story and we still have probably plenty to learn. It should be kind of pointed out that there's no link yet actually between, at least publicly, between Galthié being the actual first source of the COVID outbreak, obviously, but he has broken the strict protocols that the French government really stringently and aggressively insisted on, and made other nations probably doubt their own protocols. It's a really big deal, isn't it?
Absolutely, and unfortunate. And if he has breached those protocols, especially being the head coach, it really puts him in a compromised situation, I think. And given the tenuous nature of getting the Six Nations up and running, it's kind of been miraculous that they've been able to do so, that you just can't really risk any cancellations of games or postponements, and obviously the knock-on effect that has for the tournament, the TV, etc. So if he has breached those protocols, there probably is a basis for them to have to concede the game.
Yeah, that's my sense of it right now, to be honest, is Scotland have been the ones obviously massively disadvantaged by this, and we saw in the Autumn Nations Cup how when one camp had the COVID outbreak and was dealing with that, even without any breaking of their bubble, that the other opposition team was awarded a 28-0 win, and that almost seems fair here, particularly given we now have the confirmation that there was a breaking of that bubble, a quite flagrant one by a head coach, as you say, someone who's in a position of authority and really should know better. Obviously these are tough times for everyone, it's a family thing, you want to go see his son, but you've kind of committed to that, and I mean this is only days before the Ireland game really, and you think of it now, like, COVID still baffles me in many ways, but that outbreak in the French camp, and that Ireland came out of that game having played, obviously, 2-hour game against them, but thankfully without cases in the Irish camp. It is really crazy stuff that Galtier has made that decision. And Laporte now is really sticking by him. It's going to be interesting, even on the political side, Owen, to see what happens now. The pressure in France, as I mentioned, is really building. And the sports minister has come out and really piled that pressure on. This is just the kind of mess that we actually had joked about happening in French rugby when they finally got their house in order. It's frustrating to see.
Yeah, absolutely. But probably no better man to be at the end than Bernard Laporte. He's quite the political figure in world rugby. So if anyone's going to extract them from this situation, he's probably your man.
Yeah, I know. He's got associates and contacts everywhere, and he's been through a few controversies before. So we wait to see what happens here. Presumably Six Nations are getting involved now and they're seeking clarity as well. But really is a mess, and we wait to see what happens. We'll keep you up to date on the 42, obviously, as always. Ireland got their kind of show on the road and up and running on with the first win of the championship against Italy, as expected. A 38-point margin in the end and 6 tries to really get things rolling. We got a question from Kaylon just to kind of to tee us up. Well, first, actually, he asks, this is on the back of Craig Casey. I don't know if you saw the video of him singing Careless Whisper in the changing room afterwards for his initiation. He can sing too, in fairness to him, but he says, what would yourself and Owen's initiation song be? What's yours, Owen?
As an adopted Australian, I'll go Neighbours theme song.
That's your party piece, is it?
Yeah, because I can't sing, so just keep it as short and sweet as I can possibly keep it.
That's clever. I still stick with Oro, Shade of Ahawalia. It's a easy go-to one. Again, you don't really have to be able to sing, you just kind of roar along and then people join in, thankfully. Usually let us know, Kaylon, what you'd be singing if you were in that change room. Anyway, he says, what impressed you most, if anything, about Ireland's performance, given the lose-lose scenario that always lingers whenever you beat Italy by a good score? What do you reckon on?
I thought it was a hugely improved performance. There was a lot more accuracy in terms of turning possession, which they've had a huge amount, into points. I thought they were exceptionally efficient when they got into the 22 and invariably came away with scores. I thought their structured attack in the first half looked more accurate. When you look back at that first line at launch off the right-hand side, the variation in terms of going to Henshaw over the top, that little stack shape that we've seen the provincial sides use between Furlong and Keller was excellently executed. And then, like, for Henderson not to be awarded a try is just one of many absolute blunders this weekend in Six Nations. Hugely frustrating, because I think it would have been a great start for Ireland. And what we've been calling for is a little bit more accuracy and detail around their structured attack. And that was definitely apparent from the get-go. And the players and coaches deserve credit for that, because it's something that they would have worked on during the bye week and the week leading into the game. And I thought that was a positive sign. And then I thought they played with a huge amount of tempo. When they got quick ruck speed, that they looked dangerous in attack. I thought they tried to destructure the game a little bit. If you look at Gibson Park's quick taps, okay, they didn't always come off for them, but he was trying to create tempo in the game. And I thought Ireland looked dangerous when they did have tempo, and there was variation to their attack, whether it was trying to go through Italy or go around them. I thought there was some nice little structured attacks. Clearly still not the finished article, but there was definitely progress, I feel. And what frustrates me a little bit is a little bit of begrudgery, because it was Italy. But when France beat Italy 50-10, that's only 2 more points. And we were waxing lyrical about Dupont, Teddy Thomas, and there was no asterisks the fact they were playing Italy. So I think Ireland deserved credit for putting 48 points on Italy. It's more than what England managed in Twickenham. And only conceded the one try. I thought there was more identity in terms of their defence. They had a good plan off their restart exits. Box kicked exceptionally accurately. I thought Gibson Park's box kicking the last 2 games has been very, very good. And that allowed them, because it was so close to the touchline, it allowed Ireland bring line speed second, third phase. And we were starting to see a little bit more pressure from the Irish defensive line, which I thought had been lacking in the first 2 games. So there was definitely, in terms of identity, you could see how Ireland were trying to defend, and I thought there was progress in that regard as well.
That is a comprehensive answer. Fair play. You've jammed a lot in there that I'm going to bring you back to. I suppose let's just get the Italy one out of the way. So we had another question from Tim. He says, would Italy even compete at H Cup level? What, if anything, did we actually learn from Saturday? You think they're people should be giving Ireland a bit more credit than they're getting for this victory. Is that the sense of it?
I think so. What Ireland did in attack, I thought, was exceptionally accurate. They can only beat what's put in front of them, and I don't think their performance, we should detract from the performance because it was against Italy. Obviously, the litmus test is how they're going to back that up against Scotland and England, but all we can base our analysis on is what they did to Italy. Clearly, Italy are a struggling side at the moment with a huge amount of inexperience in their team, but we're benchmarking what Ireland did against Italy compared to what England and France have done against Italy. France are regarded as probably top three sides in the world currently. So Ireland have pretty much put in a similar performance with a similar type scoreline. So in terms of that, that's about all we can do in terms of the context of this year's Six Nations. Clearly, Italy are a poor side and Ireland are going to have to probably up that performance level. But in terms of progress, what we saw from France into Italy, I think the fundamentals of the game were in a far better place.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think Italy, for me, to this point was that I don't think they're improving actually as the championship goes on. I think that was their poorest performance. And even the stuff we saw in attack, definitely some really excellent Irish defence prevented a lot of that, but I thought they lacked that bit of accuracy. And defensively, they were just as porous as before. I was hoping that side of it would improve and that would make it more of a contest in the end. But absolutely right. The Irish attack did spark a little bit more. And Donal Peoples was asking us, have we learned much more about Ireland's attack after the win against Italy? If so, what? And can we repeat that in the next two games or only against Italy? You've kind of touched on a good bit of it there, Owen. But what did it look like to you that Ireland had been primarily focusing on in that kind of nice fortnight chunk they had before this Italy game?
Yeah, as I said, obviously their launches, a lot of their momentum came off, whether it's the line-out overthrow, or if you think back to that second Ireland try, the scoot back down the short side, whether that was something they had noticed in analysing Italy or is just something off the cuff. And we should preface that Sexton is so important to the Irish attack. They just looked like there's so much more rhythm in their attack when he is at 10. But for him to identify that space down the short side and for Gibson Park to sell open and go blindside, I thought it was a nice little sequence. And then obviously when they go out, what we've been looking for is that connection between the forwards and backs. It's a nice little link pass from Ryan. And then they go out the back of that forward shape of 10 to Ringrose. And I thought Ringrose was exceptionally good. He just looks so dangerous every time he gets in possession. His acceleration is exceptionally good. And the offload that we saw with everyone in Ireland and everyone's dog has been crying for more offloads in the Irish team, and that was an excellent sequence, brilliant running line from Keenan to anticipate the offload, and was a cracking try.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that score. To me, it was an example of heads up rugby. They absolutely mauled in field with intent, but even there the decision is not made. You know, you can still, if the maul doesn't go to plan, you're still going to play to the left hand side, you're loaded there. But I loved the way they made that decision on the move based on the picture they saw. It's simple enough stuff, as Farrell Caddick kind of pointed out. There's two defenders there, let's go at them and take that opportunity. Farrell was really pleased after the match with the connected nature of the attack, as he said, between the forwards and backs. You mentioned that the link pass from James Ryan at the back there, and then Ringrose using that second pod just to buy himself time on the ball before he offloads. Furlong in particular was a bit of a roadblock there for Brex. And then you think of the Will Connors try, obviously really nice interplay there. Kelleher using his handling skill, having punched onto the ball really well at times prior to that, and again that gives Sexton time on the ball. He did brilliantly with that little delay on his pass to Larmour, and then Connors gets rewarded for his role. He was holding the width in that kind of multi-phase passage, and he gets a reward with the offload. So there were really encouraging little bits like that will absolutely give the team confidence. That's what this game was about, wasn't it? Get a bit of momentum, a bit of belief back into it, and tries like that, Keenan one in particular, 100% do that regardless of the opposition. The frustration, I suppose, Owen, was that in the second half, it didn't kick on from there. Now, it is a big winning margin, as you point out, that's to be, I suppose, respected, and they exceeded the pre-match expectation in that sense, but they will have frustrations maybe around that stodginess and stop-start nature of the second half, which wasn't all of their doing.
Yeah, and I think that's probably important to highlight. Obviously, the injuries it was a mass substitution in terms of front rows, with both props and the hooker having to come off, which robs you of a little bit of continuity. And then I thought, when Ireland were getting into Italy's 22, obviously two penalties from 5 meter mauls from Lifter's double banking, which, let's just hope that's refereed across world rugby, because
yeah, I was going to ask you,
it isn't been, and it's one of those areas that is frustrating. Obviously, if he's talked to the team about it pre-game, that's fair enough. But there's no way he has. If he had, Ireland would have adjusted, I think, pre-game. But for him to almost, he's obviously it's been highlighted maybe by Italy, or it's something he spotted in Ireland's game. But for it to be no dialogue pre-game around it, and it's just such a technical offence that isn't being refereed, I thought that was frustrating. And the line that had been such a focal point of Ireland's attack, and it has to be highlighted, the positive influence O'Connell's having there, that it's such an important platform for Ireland to launch off. And again, in the game, it was fruitful for Ireland. So obviously that denied them two entry points when they're in the 22. There was a disallowed try for the Keller knock on in the lead up to the standard, what would have been standard second try. I felt that was probably an Italy penalty for the tackler not rolling away, which kind of obstructed Ryan's clean out. And then really frustrating was a brilliant sequence leading up to Lowe's try, which was ruled out for a four pass in case. I thought that was a lovely, I think it was probably a six phase sequence where Ireland stretched Italy. Okay, Italy are down two men at the time, but they attacked brilliantly. They went through them, they went around them. And then it was just, again, a little bit of unstructured play for Lowe to pop up outside Casey's right shoulder, and it's borderline, isn't it, whether it's flat or forward. But yeah, those four sequences, if you think of the two mauls, then the two disallowed tries, then it's probably Ireland are getting a little bit of momentum and probably a couple more scores on the board.
It was frustrating, all right. And that disallowed low one was interesting because it came on turnover, which is one of the areas we've probably discussed quite a bit in the last few weeks. It was against 13 men. I felt in the first half, though, again, that's something they still have work to do on. And by their own admission, it's something they're spending a lot of their training time on, is the more unstructured stuff. I don't see the transfer of that yet. I don't see the energy or alertness of the players. Obviously, the prime example was Lowe kicking that turnover ball away. Garbisi does well to cover back. There is initially backfield space there. And if he makes a better connection, he probably finds grass. But even still, there's a lot of guys kind of standing still. Tadhg Byrne looked frustrated not to have someone kind of inserting themselves into play down the left-hand side. And there were a couple of other examples. I mean, Johnny Sexton gets tackled into touch on one turnover attack. And a couple of others where there's just a few people standing around, and still it doesn't feel like Irish players have that fluidity on turnover ball, on kind of transition that other nations have. That is something probably owned, that it takes a while to embed that if it's not been there for I suppose previous years.
Yeah, and I actually thought there was some green shoots as well. I agree with you on the low one. There was another one in the first half. Connors gets a chop, reloads, taps the ball back, and it's turnover ball. And we actually shift the ball to the deep attacker, which is Gibson Park coming onto the ball, which is ideally what you want. And he just doesn't look up at the defender in front of him. It's actually Italy's tight head prop, and he's got Keenan coming on his inside. And if he just squared up there and ID'd the defenders, I reckon Ireland line break. But he throws a wide miss pass to Larmer, who ends up kicking long, and unfortunately it goes into the in-goal for a 22 dropout. So that was a missed opportunity. But then I thought there was some positive signs. If you look into the second half, there's a Sexton bomb. Ireland regained possession, so it's transition. And it's a brilliant cutout pass from Gibson Park to Lowe down the left edge. And unfortunately, Lowe's offload to Keller just goes forward. And then there was another sequence in the second half of kick return. Lowe and Keenan combine quite nicely down the right-hand side. They go to Stander in the pot off nine. He tips to Keller. And the neck phase, it's a lovely little blocker shape. They go around Italy to Burn on the edge. Byrne probably makes 30 metres down that left edge, and then Healy just knocks the ball on next phase uncharacteristically. So that was a little bit of a transition that Ireland attacked well off. And probably what you're talking about is the Gibson Park is a very different nine to Conor Murray. He wants to play with tempo. He wants to change the speed of the game as often as he can. And there's a quick tap in the first half when Ireland are awarded a penalty, and when Ireland award the penalty, Henshaw turns to the touch judge, because I think it's the touch judge that has given the decision. And it's like he's thanking the touch judge, but Gibson Park's already tapped and gone. And Henshaw should have been on his clean, and Ireland actually get turned over. So it's probably Henshaw being cut up, maybe in a little bit of the old regime, that those quick taps mightn't have happened in a kind of in the B zone, where it's probably either kicked to the corner or even a kickable penalty. So you're dead right, Murray, that Ireland are still trying to make those little sequences a bit more habitual and reacting to what's happening. And as I said, the positive sign is that a guy like Gibson Park is trying to destructure the game and play with tempo.
That was going to be my next question, is about him, because like you've obviously highlighted so many positive aspects of his play in the last couple of weeks. And I suppose coming into this championship, we wanted Ireland to get to the point that it's not a foregone conclusion who starts at scrum half. If Conor Murray is back now, and also Craig Casey, impressive cameo off the bench in this game. I loved his quick tap penalties, two of them. The first one really quick. The second one, again, Ireland are kind of standing round. Johnny Sexton starts walking towards him. They're thinking about what they're going to do, and he just goes, I'm going for this. Jack Conan has his hands up. He wants the ball. A big ball carrier with energy. I loved that little bit of play, and they score the next phase. Lovely pass from Johnny Sexton to hit Earls, one he's kind of thrown a few times in his career. So Casey's obviously impressed off the bench, and Gibson Park has probably taken his chances. Do you think it's a still a foregone conclusion that Conor Murray comes back into the team if he's fit for that Scotland game?
No, I don't. And I think in terms of credibility with the players, because Gibson Park is in form, has been one of Ireland's standout attackers, I think from that perspective, it's important that he's rewarded. And as I said, is what probably Conor Murray's key strength is his box kicking. I thought Gibson Park's box kicking was as accurate as any nine could have kicked at the weekend. So it would be, obviously Conor probably as a more physical presence defensively, and we've seen some frailties in that regard from Park. But I think the way Ireland are trying to play the game, I think Gibson Park suits it. And I absolutely agree that Casey gives you a little bit of energy off the bench as well. So I would hope that they stick with the two nines that were there at the weekend, and obviously give Casey a little bit more exposure at international level, because as you said, his service is really crisp. And again, he speeds up the game, has a good feel for it. And yeah, that quick tap was the catalyst to the Euros try at the end. So yeah, I thought he had a really nice cameo when he came on.
It's going to be fascinating to see what Farrell does there. As you say, it would be a reward for form, and definitely within certain section of the squad anyway would go down particularly well. We shouldn't obviously, and we wouldn't diminish Conor Murray's contributions. Obviously, really experienced campaigner when they need two wins. Again, his form coming into this championship was really quite good, and some of his, I suppose, attacking strengths are often overlooked. But it's a debate. It's great that Ireland are in that position. They spoke about building depth and having competition for places, and there hasn't been genuine competition for a start at nine, I don't think, for a long time. And Gibson Park has done enough to change the picture and probably fit in, as you say, with what Farrell wants to do. So fascinating to see what happens there. What did you make of the two debutants? So Ryan Baird, the other one, nice first carry in Test rugby. But the two of them looked, albeit against Italy, I know, and people will point that out, but they looked comfortable enough coming on and making their debuts.
Yeah, I did. I think it was nice that they brought them on at the same time as well. I thought that was quite an apt moment. But yeah, we're excited about what Baird can bring at the international level. And as you said, that first carry was a prime example. And you'd love to see him being retained in the squad, just as that point of difference off the bench, the athleticism he brings. Obviously, still a huge amount to learn. But I think there's a lot of people in Irish rugby that are keen to see him getting a little bit more exposure, and Casey as well. It's just that annoying forward pass for the low try. It just would have been a great little moment from him. Is just that little sniping ability and being able to hook in that first defender around the ruck and for Lowe to be working off his wing. Something we've wanted from Irish ringers is not to get stuck on the edges. So he brought guys into the game very well. We've mentioned his quick taps, and yeah, he looked comfortable there. He didn't look like he was overawed by the occasion, and obviously is exceptionally confident in his ability. So as you said, building a nice kind of collection of nines now that hopefully will all be able to put their hand up for selection. And the other interesting thing is the provincial combinations. If you think what didn't quite fit was the Gibson Park and Burns axis when they had not really played together, whereas now you've got Gibson Park, Sexton, and then depending on what happens with Joey Carberry, we could have a Casey Carberry connection, just looking down into the future a little bit, because I think those provincial accesses are so important to ask guys from different provinces. Obviously Murray and Sexton have combined internationally for such a long time, and that connection took some time to build as well, and it does, time is the operative word, but I think if the provincial connections can go into at international level, I think it makes for a far more cohesive halfback partnership.
That's spot on. I think Murray and Sexton will both be honest about a bit of friction maybe even at the start and not being on the same wavelength, but that's where you had identified two guys who are going to be there for a decade and you knew that it was worth giving time. It's absolutely spot on that if you're chopping and changing and guys haven't played together and it's only one off, it certainly doesn't help. Listen, who else impressed you so in terms of moving forward to Scotland? There were seven changes to Farrell's starting team. As we said, a couple of guys off the bench, you know, new to the picture in Baird and Casey, as well as Conan back in the mix. But who impressed you individually?
Yeah, I thought Will Connors was very, very strong. He probably would have been my man of the match, if I'm honest. I think he made 16 tackles, no misses. Obviously, he came up with a couple of tries. And we know his chop tackle ability is so good. And I thought he was really solid in that area again. And James Ryan, you wouldn't have thought he had been out injured. He made 17 tackles, which was the most of any Irish player in the game. And he's starting to build the little bit of skill sets in terms of what we're looking for, those connections with between forwards and backs, rather than just being a carry option. He's now got that link and tip ability, which I think is a crucial part to his game. I thought Ronan Keller made a strong debut. I think he gives Ireland a point of difference in terms of his physical prowess. He was hitting hard in contact, especially in and around the tackle, and carried pretty well. Obviously, he had the one crooked line out throw, but outside of that, I thought he gave an excellent 60-minute performance on his first start. So from a pack perspective, I think they were the standout players. Obviously, great to see Furlong and Kilcoyne come back into it after a long layoff, and building that depth on loose head and tight head, I think is very important for Ireland. And then, yeah, as I said, the standout back for me was Ringrose. I just feel like every time he touches the ball, he was Ireland's leading carrier with standard, which is great. I think that's really positive when your midfielder is touching the ball as much as your number eight and getting opportunities to go at the line and use his footwork and acceleration. And for me, he's the nailed-on starter at 13 for the Lions. If they were to pick a team tomorrow, I just think he looks so dangerous. And has grown into a kind of real leader in the midfield for Ireland.
He looked really motivated to nail every chance he got on the ball. Really nice variety to his game as well. And I'm with you on all those guys you flagged. It's nice for him to have a couple of decisions now to make, even in the front row. Porter's been excellent, but Furlong obviously is a world-class tight head. As you say, Kilcoyne probably put his hand up and showed his ability to be destructive. The Hooker one is going to be fascinating, and you would imagine Paul O'Connell has a strong say in that, given the set piece stuff and Herring's reliability around that area. It's obvious that Keller is a more explosive athlete, but that's not the entire game. So fascinating to see what happens there. And I agree on Connors. Thought he was really excellent, put his hand up for a start. The back row is going to be really interesting on Henderson and Ryan. I think it's obvious they start in the second row. Do you think Byrne did enough to be the six against the Scots, or do you change that based on the opposition?
No, I think Byrne obviously was given man of the match. Excellent at the breakdown, both sides attacking and defensive breakdown. I think he was Ireland's leading player in that regard. We saw his mobility on the edge with Ireland looking to have a back row on the edge. And again, I think it's probably similar to the Gibson Park one, where that's back-to-back man of the match performances for Byrne, or at least in two of the three games. And to maintain credibility with the playing group, I think there's not much more Byrne could have done. And I think selecting on current form is something that is crucially important, and not relying on reputations of players coming back in. We all know Omani's leadership ability, but I think selecting on form, and if a guy's put his hand up, then he should probably maintain the jersey, would be my opinion.
I have a sense it's going to be very close to the same starting team again, if not even the 23. Like Farrell was quick to kind of highlight Conan's energy off the bench, as you mentioned, that example, putting his hand up to be a carrier and a bit of change up there. I think Baird definitely has a role to play just with his explosive contributions, his energy. Even though he's smiling coming onto the pitch, you love to see that kind of stuff. Someone who just wants to be out there. And even in the pack, yeah, I thought it worked really well. And Byrne, again, the way they're trying to move this team, he's a footballer, he's a baller. He can pass, he can link, he can offload. He wants to be in those wide channels as well. And I thought it worked really well. So I wouldn't be too surprised if we don't see too much change. But one question we did get around that is from Michael in the members' WhatsApp group. He says, will Stockdale come back into the reckoning for the last two games? And he says, if not, actually, how do you see Stockdale versus Lowe turning out in the future? Lowe has great power, but when in form, Stockdale's ability to slide through tackles is outstanding. Both of them, of course, have defensive issues. What's your sense of how this develops, Owen? Because it is going to be a really interesting one. Both probably primarily left wings.
Yeah, both left footers. Both hugely exciting in attack. And both with their defensive deficiencies, as mentioned. I really like James Lowe, I have to say. I think he gives Ireland an extra element in attack. I think he's powerful. I think his work rate in attack to work off his wing, his feel for the game, I think is very good. And he's feeling his way into international rugby, as Farrell pointed out after the game. They understand his strengths and that they want to give him time there to try and find his feet at that level. And Stockdale, his try-scoring record is incredible, isn't it? He's one of the most talented wingers that Ireland have produced over the last 20 years. I'd like to see them both in the back three, if I was honest. It would be a little bit of a gamble, given on what we've discussed, defensive and possibly high ball, at times high ball frailties. And Larmer's done nothing wrong, but potentially if you could move Larmer to the right wing, Hugo Keenan to the right wing, Stockdale to 15 and Lowe on the left, it would be all out attack. Or potentially James Lowe at 15. I don't see why he couldn't do a job there either. It would actually help him maybe defensively, that he's not having to make those reads on the edge in terms of that winger defensive role. He's more in that closing in last man defense, so that potentially might help him out a little bit. But Lowe at 15 could be an option too. Probably gives him a little bit more freedom to roam and attack as well. So yeah, great to have options. And Larmer as well, who unfortunately went off injured, but he looked sharp in that first 40 minutes too. So plenty of attacking options for Ireland in the back three, which is exciting. Yeah,
it's going to be fascinating. I actually do think Stockdale will be back in for those last two games. He came back for 40 minutes there for Ulster on Friday night. Looked like they'd kind of planned to take him off at halftime. And Robert Balakun, another guy who could be in the mix with Ireland pretty soon in the future. He's got a real potential. He came on at halftime. But Stockdale looked good. He looked sharp, fresh, fit, aggressive, focused, and he obviously wants to get back in for those last two big games as Ireland try to finish strong. So it'll be really interesting to see how they get that balance to it. God, it would be exciting to have the pair of them going forward. And you just feel like Lowe, it just is inches away from clicking. Obviously that try disallowed, a couple of times where he nearly gets offloads away against the Italians, and you feel that when that does start flowing, that it really will go strongly. And Farrell clearly believes in the guy. He got him straight in as soon as he could, and I think he's going to stick with him. He's talking about getting continuity into him. The same with Gibson Park, two guys who, listen, they're not young guys at all, and they've plenty of experience, but at this level are learning as they go. And certainly Lowe looks like he's in it for the long haul. Listen, before we move on to the Wales-England game, just a heads up that this week's episode of Behind the Lines sees Gavin Cooney chatting with Stephen Jones. Some of you are definitely going to enjoy this one.
Yeah, well, Eddie is, he is entertaining. Also, I think a lot of the time, he's a complete prat. I really do. And it's so, I mean, when England lost to Scotland, he gave the reason why they lost on the Sunday in the press conference. It had changed on the Monday. Changed again on the Tuesday. On the Wednesday, it was the ref's fault. You know, I mean, I don't, if I was Eddie, I'd hate to read all that press stuff. But what he says is sometimes non-sequitur, doesn't follow. Sometimes it's a lame excuse, and sometimes it's pure rubbish.
Yeah.
You mix that in with his good stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think he thinks it is his team, and it isn't. It's England's team. And I think that he needs a captain to speak out and to give it all another counterpoint, because, you know, it's all Eddie Jones, Eddie Jones.
The episode in full is out for all of the 42 members tomorrow, Tuesday, the 2nd of March. But on this Wales-England game was just incredible in terms of the number of big incidences. I don't know if you've seen the coverage from France, but Joel Juche, the head of referees from World Rugby, he's come out and said that he spoke to Pascal Gauzère, and Pascal Gauzère recognised that he made some errors. These were big ones to make. And listen, we're going to get on to the rest of the game, but these two errors were pretty crazy ones at this level.
Oh, my days. I couldn't believe it when I watched it. Oh, yeah. It brought me back to, was it Ireland, South Africa, maybe in the mid-2000s, I think, when the referee, was it Stuart Dickinson, maybe, told John Smith to go and talk to his team. And I reckon they were still in the huddle when Raj took the quick tap. And I can't remember who the referee was. I'm going to say Dickinson. Anyway, he was not awarding that try when Lansdowne Road went absolutely mental. So it reminded me of that. Obviously, Pascal Gauzère didn't have the pressure of a full Millennium Stadium to deal with. But it just looked wrong. And generally, when something looks wrong, it's wrong. And when you go and tell your captain to go and talk to his team, you can't just turn time on and allow play to continue. You've got to allow the defensive line reset. The wingers have obviously come a long way in to be have the chat with the captain on the request of the referee. So once the wingers come in to listen to what Farrell has to say, he's got to give them equal time to get back into their defensive position. So just such a naive error, and it's just, he loses a huge amount of credibility, doesn't he, for not having the composure to understand he had made the wrong decision and not award the try. You'd be very frustrated if you're in the English camp.
It highlights the pressure of it all, I suppose, that you made an error, you have a quick chance, maybe a couple of seconds to go, actually, I've got this wrong. But often we see match officials under that pressure double down on it. And Farrell pointed out, listen, I actually think there were 5 water carriers on the pitch at the time, so they're still in amongst the players. There's a couple of Welsh huddles even at the time the kick goes. And it's just unfair. Yeah, the time's on and you can say Ford and Watson were sleepy or slow to move back, but you've got to give them time to get their shape again. I thought it was deeply unfair. And then the Lewis Reece Samet one, like, it's crazy. I saw the comments from Joel Juche said, when you get into the TM process, we often find ourselves with this microscope trying to find a way when it seems so obvious. That's just a knock on. Yeah, it comes off his leg, but he's lost the ball forward.
Yeah, and I don't know who the TMO was. Obviously a French TMO, but just again, the commentary, everyone, players' reaction was all, oh, knock on, let's get on with the game. It wasn't. And the more replays that happened, you went, oh my God, the harder they're looking at this, the more worried I was getting. And it was just clear and obvious again. And again, it's just that credibility factor that, especially the TMO, like, he's there for one job. It's been referred to him. And how he's seen that isn't a knock-on is beyond me, to be honest.
Yeah. And listen, like, everyone makes mistakes. Obviously, I make mistakes in my job all the time. And I do think all these guys will continue to ref. Gauzère will be doing international matches and he'll learn from it. But it is a lesson, I suppose, that when something is that obvious, someone's got to speak up. It was Alex Ruiz doing the TMO. And even after that, and Gauzère is obviously kind of wondering himself, he says, does anyone have a different opinion? And Frank Murphy and Andrew Bass are the assistant referees, and they're probably hesitant to kind of step on someone else's toes. And it was just a big one to get wrong, and obviously England were frustrated at the time. They made a game of it, to be fair to them, but a lot of the focus post-match has been around their discipline. Lorcan Murphy in the members group was asking, was the margin reflective of the game for Wales? And he points out a few of the things we've spoken about, including maybe Itoje getting yellow card. But what did you think? Was it reflective of the game, the winning margin in the end?
I don't think so. I think when we talk about discipline, that last quarter will be hugely frustrating for England. The 4 soft penalties they give up. Itoje with a side entry at the mall for his 5th penalty. There was a one at the breakdown. It's a really lazy carry from Vunipola where England are setting up to box kick. They're in their own half. And Vunipola actually turns his back into contact and doesn't give Genge a target to cling to. And Genge ends up off his feet and in the side. And then there was another one. It's still a six-point game. There's only maybe 7-8 minutes left. It's a Welsh line-out in the Welsh 22. And you go, okay, even if Wales kick out, you're going to have an attacking line-out, probably 30, 35 from the Welsh line. And they give away a penalty for jumping across at the line-out. Again, very, very soft. Those soft penalties just killed England off without Wales having necessarily done a lot. When you combine the two tries that weren't tries, it probably doesn't reflect the game. Because while I thought Wales had a pretty clear tactic, no rugby in their own half, they kicked the ball 33 times. Box kicked an inordinate amount of times. I think Kieran Hardy box kicked 13 times. So they just didn't play any rugby in their own half. And probably the interesting thing is with Jonathan Davis and George North in the midfield, they had far more power to punch through England than England's back line is actually looking a little bit more callow now, isn't it? When you think Ford, Farrell, Slade, Access, they're all in that 10 type mold. And they're relying on, I think, of the 41 carries from their forwards, Sinclair and Vunipola carried 27 times. So they're relying on those two guys for a huge amount of their go forward, and England aren't getting a huge amount of punch from their backs, and they're probably falling in love with a little bit of a wide game with those three midfielder or three distributors in at 10, 12, 13. And there were some nice sequences from England at times, definitely. And you could see the kind of where they're trying to expand their game to. But I thought Wales probably had a little bit more power in their backs. Obviously, Jonathan Davis coming back is a big coup for them. And Josh Adams back on the wing, he's got a brilliant try-scoring record for Wales. And when you look at that seven for Wales, they probably had a little more an abrasiveness and a little bit more power than England did in their backs.
England at their best under Eddie Jones. It's Manu Tuilagi at his best, isn't it? It's him rampaging. It's him giving them the midfield carry option. It's him getting them first phase over the gain line every single time with the ability to actually play a little bit as well. He's an unbelievably important player for them and unbelievably world-class player, as has been Mauro Itoje in everyone's eyes. But now he's got a lot of question marks around him after this game. You mentioned a few penalties there, five of them in total. First off, did you think he should have been yellow carded? Because loads of people have been asking about that.
Yeah, I think five penalties, you deserve a yellow card, yeah. Even the frequency at which England gave up penalties, I think I was surprised that the referee didn't go to the bin, and possibly he goes there, probably had in the back of his mind, definitely the first try wasn't a try. Probably was trying to square things off a little bit, but yeah. He just plays on the edge, doesn't he? He's such a nuisance, and he does so much good work in terms of pressuring nines in around the kicking game and things like that. But probably just another indication of that Saracens contingent that the gamble probably hasn't paid off for Eddie Jones in that regard, in terms of selecting those guys that have played very, very little rugby, none from a club perspective, and not having a rhythm and a kind of continuity of games probably has denied those guys of performing at their top level, and such an integral axis to England, the kind of spine of their team. Itoje, Farrell and Daly, you would say, are not performing at the lofty levels they've set themselves from the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. Gozer probably would have actually punished England even further, I think, if it wasn't in the back of his mind. He doesn't like Owen Farrell. I would think that was clear. And it was actually clear that Reynal doesn't like Johnny Sexton either. I actually think it's a bit of an issue when the referee patently does not like your captain. I think people can be great leaders, but sometimes they're not the best choice for that specific role of actually going over and talking to the ref. And sometimes I wonder, does it do harm to those two teams in particular? They're very abrasive personalities and they can really rub referees up the wrong way. Obviously on other occasions they say the right thing and they pressure the right way, but it is interesting. And the Itoje one, like, he's always played on the edge. If you think of some of the Think of the one on Kieran Hardy where he strips him just after the knee is down. And in fairness, that happened the other way around later on in the game, and it wasn't a penalty against Wales. George North rips the ball or reefs the ball away from Slade, but that's close to brilliance from Itoje, where you go, wow, what an incredible play, coming through the line out, snaffling the ball. There's a couple of them other, the Ruck one, where the Ruck, as Gozer says, shifts backwards. That was a tough pen because he is onside, and then one of the Welsh lads falls through, and that's tough. I agree, though, once you get to five, you've got a yellow card, and particularly given that he'd already had that kind of side entry at the mall, and it was a repeated infringement even in that instance. And their discipline was really poor, and absolutely in the end game, it cost them dearly. But Wales deserve absolute credit for what they did as well, Owen. Yeah, they didn't play rugby in their half, but what did they do well to actually put themselves into the position? Yes, they got a bit of luck with those tries, a good degree of luck, but there was some really good stuff there as well, and they've turned their championship around in impressive fashion.
Yeah, even I thought their attacking kicking game, they turned England quite regularly, even in the attacking half. If you think of the Josh Adams left foot grubber, which leads to the Liam Williams try, it's the Adams short kick that Rhys Ammett latches onto, and I thought they turned England. Even if you think when Callum Sheedy came on, a couple of nice little attacking kicks, his first line break when he goes back at the line and kicks through, I thought he had a really positive impact. And to be fair to the Welsh coaching staff, they trusted those guys, like bringing Callum Sheedy on. Halaholo had a positive impact as well. And I think the other thing that Wales really have to take a huge amount of credit to is their set piece. When we remember the Welsh line-out and scrum from the autumn internationals, it was absolutely abysmal. And they had no chance of winning any game. And when you're playing a kick-heavy game and you're looking at trying to play with territory, you need your set piece to function. And I think Wales won 16 of their 17 lineouts or something like that, and they were able to launch off their scrum as well with their last try coming from that right hand side scrum. So a huge amount of credit to the coaching staff to be able to turn their set piece into a little bit of a weapon again for them. And then, as I said, I thought they maintained possession and looked to milk penalties out of England once they got into the BA zone and leveraged their power runners. Of Faletau was their leading ball carrier again, made most meters. And as I said, that access of Davies and North in the middle just allowed them to punch into England's midfield defence. And yeah, it wasn't a hugely ambitious game plan, but they executed it well. And I just think the Six Nations is just all about momentum, isn't it? If you go back to that first game, if Ireland had got that 5 meter line out in the end, who knows? But Wales have grown in belief, and that's a hugely important part of professional sport, is the players believing in the direction the team is going in, and you can see their confidence has grown enormously as the competition has developed.
And you need things to go your way, you absolutely do. We look at any championship and there's things that could have gone the other way that fall in your favour. That's part of it. But absolutely, they've grasped every one of them now, really. And their belief level's clearly improving. The energy off them is excellent. I like the way they've been rewarded for backing players like Lewis Rhys-Ammett's one. Obviously, a prodigious talent. And I think most countries will be getting him straight into their team. But he's getting better every time he plays. He looks so confident. His pace is just startling. Like Johnny May, when he burned him at that stage, I know he's fatigued and he's chasing back after the Sheedy intercept, but he's just such a thoroughbred sprinter. It was a joy to watch, and lucky not to score there. He was very honest, I suppose, when he saw the replay of his own knock-on. I think his expression gave it away. But him, Kieran Hardy, a guy he's 25 now. He's never started a Champions Cup game. He played two seasons in the Championship with Jersey Reds very recently and just kind of came out of nowhere. But Pivac has really backed his rise, picked him ahead of Gareth Davies, the more experienced option, and got great reward. The try obviously being the highlight, really clever, and again brilliant to see a player taking advantage of those situations where opposition do turn their back. It's straight in front of the posts, everyone's thinking, oh, they're just going to pop over the three, and Daly actually has his back completely turned and he just snipes away. Really enjoyed that, and enjoyed the way they're getting the best out of players. So I mean, we joked about that as well. We joked about them winning a Grand Slam, but it looks like it's going to happen. Crazy stuff. And we look forward to seeing what happens there. But listen, just to wrap, we're going to have a look around the world of rugby, really. So much going on. Australia win for, massive win for the Brumbies was, I suppose, the headline over there. Waratahs under Rob Penny, our old friend over here, really seem to be struggling on.
Yeah, a record-breaking win for the Brumbies. And the Waratahs are under a huge amount of pressure with only two games gone. Brumbies just have, they're the most settled squad in Australian rugby from in terms of their coaching staff and also their playing group. They've maintained a huge amount of their roster from last year and experienced coaches in Larry Fisher and Dan McKellar. And they're evolving the game. They're definitely looking to evolve their attack, not just solely relying on the line at Maul, which obviously still gives them so many entry points into the game, but they were just far too powerful for what is a callow and young New South Wales Waratahs side. There's quite a lot of criticism over in Australia in terms of their list management and how the powers that be have not planned for, particularly after the World Cup in 2019, when it was very, very apparent that their high-profile Wallabies were going to look to go overseas. And what they had been blessed with for a number of years was Foley and Michael Hooper literally played every single game for the Waratahs for about a six-year period, did not miss a game through injury or selection. And what that meant is that guys in behind them just weren't being blooded, and it's probably been the factor in a number of positions. And yeah, they've lost all of their Wallaby contingent effectively and are starting from scratch. And it's going to be a big rebuild for the Waratahs. And Rob Penny is already feeling the pressure over that side of the world. So yeah, tough start to 2021 for the Taz.
I wonder are Matt Tumua's ribs feeling better after that massive hit from from Paisami. That was a massive bit of contact. But a lot of ill-discipline in this game that was decisive, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of points coming through penalties. Pretty much all Melbourne Rebels points came from kicks. And the Queensland Reds looked to try and play with tempo off their penalties. So lots of quick taps. They had obviously gone into the game with the idea of kind of running the Rebels off their feet. Obviously, the Rebels didn't play in round one and didn't have any preseason games going into the season. So that was their approach, but it didn't quite work for the Reds, and they could persisted with that plan even though their set piece was starting to get on top. Obviously, a pretty experienced pack that played together for a number of years now up in Queensland. So the Rebels just hung in there and were kind of going 3-6-9 and applying scoreboard pressure on the Reds. But probably the crucial part of the game was a red card to the reserve tight head Fiau Patuaka for a direct contact to the head at another one of those breakdown cleanouts. So while the Reds went down to 14 men, it meant that Taniela Tupou came back onto the field, and he had a huge influence in that last 20 minutes. And the Reds kind of squeaked home with two tries from Alex Maffey, one off a Maul and one off a clever little line out peel close to the line. But yeah, gutted for Matt Tumua. He had a penalty kick on the bell to win the game, ironically off a Hunter Paisami high tackle last play. And it was a tough kick, probably on the 15 and on the 10-meter. And he just missed it to the left. It would have been a really great win for the Rebels. Would have got their season off to a flying start because no one had fancied them to go up to Queensland, as I said, off a bye round one. But they'll be happy with how their season has started. Frustrating not to come away with a win, but with the border restrictions in Australia, they've now had to go on the road again. They go back to Canberra. They've switched their home game in Melbourne to an away game against the Brumbies, and then go over to Perth round four to play Rob Kearney's team over in Perth. So a tough old stint for them again on the road for another month before coming back to Melbourne.
It ain't easy. Good to see Super Rugby Aotearoa getting underway in New Zealand as well. The Blues beating the Canes with so much nice rugby played in that game. If people can get a chance to watch it back, or even the highlights, or even just the Asafo Amua try, it's going around on Twitter, I think on Brett Igo's page. Really beautiful score just after they regain a restart. Ardy Savea playing a really important role in it. And then you had the Crusaders beating the Highlanders, but a really encouraging debut for young Irishman Jack Regan, a 23-year-old guy who left the Ulster Academy and moved to New Zealand last March and is really thriving down there. He got a start for Tony Brown's side and didn't get too many carrying, tackling opportunities, but thought there was some nice link play from him. Did his work in the line out really unfussily. He got in a bit of a scuffle with Joe Moody earlier on. I don't know if you see that one, Owen, where he smacked him a few times with the open palm. And actually, since I've seen that, Ben O'Keefe has come out and said that, listen, that should be a yellow card, as we all probably felt at the time. But always good to see the Irish guys abroad going really well, and we'll keep tuned to that over the next few weeks as well. But Irish guys doing well at home was a bit of a story of the weekend here, Owen. And Joey Carberry, I suppose, chief among them, his return, long-awaited return, as Munster really dug out a win in Cardiff, not their best performance, but they got a job done. But everyone just thrilled to see a guy as talented as Joey Carberry back in the pitch. Really exciting stuff.
Yeah, I would say a big relief for the obviously the medical and coaching staff down there, as well as Joey himself. It's been such an extended period out of the game, which would have been so frustrating. But yeah, just one of the good news stories of 2021. Hopefully they keep coming. But look good from the time he had on the pitch. Obviously a great conversion from that right side. And just, let's just hope he gets a run of games together. I know there's been some chat about him potentially going straight into the Ireland squad, but I think he, after such a long time out, he just needs a run of games at club level, and then hopefully then we see him in an international context maybe later in the summer. But yeah, all credit to obviously the medical staff and Joey himself to getting himself back in a position to play.
The conversion was a really great moment for him. Obviously, no one would have been even noted it if he'd missed it. It was a tough kick, but you just kind of sense that this is a guy getting back, saying this is my opportunity, just to underline that I'm back. This is my team. I'm going to carry things forward. And he looked good even around the pitch. His first touch was a nice delay on his pass. He takes a bit of a heavy hit from Ray Lilo, but probably welcomed that in many ways, getting stuck in again. And really looking forward to seeing him build. As you say, they've got to be patient with it. As we mentioned, good to see Stockdale, Ballacoon, also Sean Reedy back for Ulster. They had a 21-7 win over the Ospreys. Poor Rob Little had three disallowed tries. And the third one he does, the big kind of ash splash, and he has that relief of finally scoring, but also chalked off. So I've never seen that before, but unlucky for him. Good win for Connacht, late victory against Benetton. It was Bundy Aki with the last gasp try, having conceded the penalty that looked like it was going to lose the game for Connacht. So happy days for them. And Oisin Dowling, I thought, was really impressive in his first start for the province. He's had that back injury, but returned the last couple of weeks and has been impressive. And then finally, we had Leinster on yesterday in a jam-packed weekend, as we said. A few worries for Harry Byrne with his injury, and fingers crossed we'll hear a positive update on that. But I just want to get your thoughts on that red card for Adam Hastings. We've seen this a couple of times in the last few months, even seasons. What was your sense of it? Was it a justified one? Is it something that we need to get out of the game?
Yeah, I think just poor technique. You really don't want that the leg to come forward and your boots to be showing, your studs to be showing. He probably just gets caught under the ball a little bit, which leads him to lean back, and then that leg to come up. And you just can't have studs showing, especially in the face of an opposition player. It's probably just poor technically. And yeah, I think referee probably had no choice but to go red.
I'm in agreement with you there. So listen, to wrap, we're waiting on the France story to update. We'll see what happens there in terms of the Six Nations. But just on Ireland, they have a fortnight, obviously, until their next game. What do you anticipate they'll be most focusing on in these couple of weeks? And how do you sense the mood will be around the squad after notching that win?
Yeah, I think they'll be hugely positive. Obviously, the difficulty for us is we don't have the context of being in camp to know what they're working on, how they're previewing teams, their game plan, and what parts of their game plan they're executing them well, and what detail they're missing on. So without that context, it's a little bit difficult. But I think they'll definitely take confidence that they feel they're going in the right direction. I definitely saw positive signs in terms of their attack, as we've discussed. And it's building on that confidence. As we said, the mindset is sometimes as important as the technical and tactical preparation for games. So obviously Ireland have a very good record against Scotland in recent years, and they'll be obviously buoyed by the result and confident in past performances against Scotland. So I think it'll be a fascinating game, and both teams looking to attack. So Hopefully we get dry weather over in Edinburgh.
Yeah, we can't wait for that one. Liz Nolan, great stuff as always. Really appreciate it.
Cheers, Murray.
And thanks to everyone for the questions and for tuning in. As always, really appreciate your support. We're back again on Thursday with the regular pod, so we'll catch up then. Cheers.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could offer me 5 mil a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Johnny Moe!
Robbie Weekly.
Little reverse pass, and goal! Oh!